I'm the, what am I?
Chair?
I don't know, president
not
chair.
Not very much, just
there's,
chair.
There's so many boards and stuff you forget.
What am I doing here today?
Anyway, I'm Lydia Sanders. I'm the chair of the CAF board, and I'm delighted to be here. I also work for Battle Ground School District. We have a brand new resource guide. If anyone wants any, please feel free to grab it. Any. So, should we go around?
I'm Mavis Nichols. I'm the Battle Ground School Board, but I'm here because she made me.
And I'm secretary. I'm Sharington, and
thank you, God. Wow.
Income representative, and
I'm Judith Walsup, and I'm the community rep for District 2, which is in the East County.
Nancy Schultz, new card, new member. Not sure what district.
Janet with Clark County.
Ty Stewart, City of Nashville.
Rebecca Royce, Clark County. And I want to introduce, at last, we have hired for Kate's position. This is Kelly Molina. She comes from Oklahoma City, so she's flown a long ways to come see us. So she'll be taking over a lot of the duties that Kate once had. She's learning all the different agencies and programs that we have here in Clark County. But I'll let her introduce more about her stuff. So we're excited to have her.
So yeah, I have I worked in for the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services in Oklahoma. And so I did program administration for the homeless and housing programs for people with mental illness. So and then before that I did direct care, provided direct services as a case manager. And care coordinator, and then I also did some psychiatric rehabilitation with adults. So.
Very cool.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Oklahoma.
Where?
Oh, Oklahoma City. Well, Edmond, really, but okay. Yeah.
Are you familiar with that? Another Oklahoma girl.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
I grew up in right to Vancouver.
My husband was hired by OHSU, and so, yeah, he does grants administration for them, so...
I just do a lot of administration.
Yeah, apparently.
We have children.
We don't have any children, no.
Awesome.
Except for the dog.
We have a dog.
Well, welcome. We're excited to work with you, and welcome to the Northwest. It's not usually as smoky as it has been.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're glad you're here. So we need an approval of the July minutes. We have quorum?
Yes, we have quorum.
Okay, good. Do we have a motion? Okay. Is there any further discussion? Great. And all in favor?
Aye.
And the motion passes. Well, the action passes. So July minutes are approved. Great. And then the Clark County report to the community. So this guy right here. It should have all of our pictures in it, so I think we're all delighted. I'm very happy that we have staff pictures included because staff has done so much work. This really is an amazing document, you guys. Not only does it look really cool, but it provides a lot of really awesome information. So if everyone wants to peruse that a little bit, Rebecca, do we need to... approve that?
Yes, so okay. We had a formal adoption.
Okay.
I took some of the feedback that you guys had given at the last meeting and incorporated in. For example, one of the things that was asked was to really let the public know that reads this, the services that are discussed within this report are just a piece of what's going on in the community. So, we found a really great place to highlight it where there wasn't a whole lot of other stuff going on the index page on page 3, and so we really wanted to highlight that out, make that known that, you know, this is just part of what goes on in our community, what's being highlighted in here. We just wanted to make some of those minor changes and made sure that everything was called out correctly within the full report. And once it's adopted today, we will get it up on our website and we will send it that to our stakeholders list, so it will go far and wide. I'll make sure to copy the board on that. And we'll be able to print it, and if you need copies to distribute, we can, we'd be happy to do that for you and make it available as far and wide as possible.
Very cool. Has everyone had a chance to review that a little bit? Cool. So then is there any, do we need to have more discussion about it, or do we have a motion to go ahead and approve it?
I'll move to adopt the Clark County report to the committee.
Excellent. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you. So it looks like that motion is approved.
No,
we're
going to
ask. Oh. What do I do
all
now?
In favor? Discussion.
All in favor.
Aye.
Thanks.
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
Any opposed? Great. Now can we say the motion is approved? Okay. Great. So that, I'm excited that that'll really be out there. But I think it is important to also note that.
This is our this is the report we love to do every year.
Yeah.
So a report to the community.
But it's important that it's, that people know that that's only a part of what's out there. So it's, but it's a great part and important. So now we have some task force updates. Rebecca, do you want to help us with that?
Yeah, so in this first one, we're going to talk more about the community needs assessment a little bit later in the agenda. So for this one, we wanted to focus on the advocacy efforts task force. At the last meeting, we had talked about, do we want to keep this task force going? You know, it was originally intended to be about a year-long process to really help identify what is advocacy and how the board can get involved. And we've put a roadmap together, which the group did a great job with. And at the last meeting, we talked about, it sounded like there was pretty good consensus that we'd like to keep this task force going for a longer time. But what we wanted to do is have a discussion about what that would look like. And when we met with the executive team, they came up with a really good idea as one of the projects that, that can be taken on by this group is to create like advocacy elevator speeches. So little 30-second, 60-second synopsis on different topics that we cover, because this group does cover a wide range of issues, you know, not just homelessness, not just anti-poverty. And within anti-poverty, there's several different things. There's employment, there's affordable housing, there's credit repair. I mean, there's a lot of different components that kind of fall under this. One of the key things that staff has really not been able to keep up with is being able to staff this group for just because our staff levels went down and so we didn't have that. And with bringing Callie on, I had a discussion with her, and so she is happy to be the staff lead for this new advocacy task force. So we're really appreciative, not only just to have her, but for her to be taking on that role for us for the board. So today we wanted to have a quick discussion on things that we might want to include besides those elevator speeches for the task force, but also to see from the original group if you're still interested in being on the task force, or if there's any other members that would like to be on the task force. So we thought maybe we would just start kind of from scratch and just see who would be interested in being on the task force itself.
I'm sorry, are we talking about the advocacy task force?
Yes.
I'm happy to. I just have a limited schedule, so that's all I can do. I've already
been So we have Nancy and Lydia. Is anyone else interested in being on the task force?
I'm interested, but my time is limited during the winter, so that's, I'm glad to be on and come when I can.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Sheree would like to stay on? Okay. I think that's a good size. Four is a good size of an advocacy group. So, Kelly will get in contact with you to set up like the first meeting, and then you guys can talk about who would be the chair and if that's sure he wants to continue in that role. I'm gonna just make that have that discussion, and then kind of do a map of what will happen. Is there anything that you guys can think of besides doing these elevator speeches that should be a topic for the advocacy group to kind of think about?
Go ahead.
I was thinking that. It, if there are community groups that we could identify and have people go talk to briefly, or just, you know, find the, in terms of advocacy about what the CAP does and things like that. I realized when I had gone to the CAMA city manager, you were going the next week, and I didn't realize that, you know, so that kind of thing. At least identifying.
I'm thinking that, you know, I'm pretty new and I should be listening, not talking, but yeah, I'm kind of excited about the legislative advocacy aspect. I'm thinking that one of the things we should do at the beginning is describe the parameters of what our job is going to be. Not just the elevator speeches, which I think is a great idea, but how far are we going to be advocating? Are we going to go into Olympia and talking to legislators, that kind of thing? Or even Washington, D.C. So I think that's one of the things we need to talk about. What are our priorities?
Kind of the guidelines around
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I agree, and I think that's what that task force can definitely parse out. I was just going to add, too, that I think that as much as any of us could do within our communities to get the word out there, maybe each of us could challenge ourselves to reach out to some group, no matter what it might be, in our county, in our state, to let them know that we do exist. I think I'm not sure that the people, the general public, really know that we exist or what we do, and so it would be great to get the word out there more.
I just suggested to Battleground City Council, as Lydia has ever been a presentation there, and she didn't think so, and I don't think we ever really heard about CAP on the school board, so mm-hmm. school boards might be a good place to start because of what we do for kids. So,
yeah, well, maybe some sort of an outreach plan.
Absolutely.
That's
fine. Yeah.
So if each of us reached out within our communities to groups like that and organizations.
Neighborhood Association.
Absolutely.
The Neighborhood Alliance.
Rotaries.
There you go.
Chambers. That's
mm-hmm. right. Does everyone feel comfortable doing that?
Sure.
I know Ty does.
I don't mind doing it.
Everybody comfortable speaking in front of other people?
As long as you give me what I'm supposed to say.
Right.
And those elevator speeches will really play
yeah.
right
yes.
into that.
And it doesn't have to be a long formal presentation.
No.
It can be a 5-minute, hey, we exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think just even that.
Here's
but again, those parameters around mm-hmm. what we should and shouldn't.
Here's what we do.
Yep.
Here's who we are.
Yep.
Here's how we get where we are.
Yep.
Yeah, and for that type of thing, you know, that's where we can step in and make sure we have copies of them because we don't want you guys trying to print this out.
Mm-hmm.
30 pages.
Does everyone feel comfortable if the task force comes up with those kind of more guidelines and parameters, and we've done some work on that,
mm-hmm.
Then reaching out to the rest of our board to say, okay, each of us, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And being asked to do that kind of work, I think we could make some good progress if we did that.
Cool.
We'd
love to
share
that.
Yeah, I think that'd be awesome. Right. Any other discussion? Okay. Anything else you want to add? So legislative update.
So there's not a whole lot. We're kind of in between what's going on. I haven't heard anything from this. Well, I guess I have. So we've received our consolidated homeless grant or our CHG allocation. And so we have some contracts that are getting modified right now to show that the state goes on a biennium. It's a July 1 through June 30th, and it's a 2-year contract. And so when we get to our quarterly report that we'll talk about a little bit later, I'll talk about those actual programs that are getting contract extensions. And so that's what's happening at the state level. We did get also a little bit of extra money that we were very surprised to get from CSBG at the federal level. And so it's not enough to do anything new. It was like $15,000, so it was not a lot to do it. So what we talk about and what I've been hearing from several agencies is how expensive it is to get documents translated into specifically Chukis, but just the cost of getting their documents translated for their programs. And so what we thought we would do is just put a call out to all our community action and home housing providers and say, are there documents that you need translated? So they came back with 71 documents, anywhere from 1 to 3 translations. They were all either Spanish, Russian, or Chukis, and some of them wanted just Spanish, some of them wanted Spanish and Russian, some of them wanted Spanish, Russian, and Chukis. I just sent those last week to 5 different agencies to translate or to get bids on translating them, and I got my first bid back, and it came in at $11,000, so right in where I expected, because I figure 71 documents, and they're up to 3 times, so you have almost 200 documents.
What was that third language?
No,
what is Chukis?
So Chukis is a population that's growing very quickly here in Vancouver for the last couple of years. It's a Pacific Islander group, and finding translation services is very difficult for that specific population, but it's been growing quite a bit.
Guam is one of the
primary
places.
Maybe with a bigger population, we'll find more people that would be able to help translate.
Well, yeah, and we can get documents translated. They're having even more issues finding an actual translator to come in when they have a family come in for services, so that's the hardest part there. So we are excited to do this for our agencies because it's an expensive thing to have done, and we want to make sure that we're responsive and have our documents available in their native language. I mean, it just makes sense, so.
So are those documents, are they documents that change often, or are they pretty standard?
Pretty standard. For example, the HMIS release of information was one of them, and that goes across all of our programs, so it's great to have it in now 4 languages, English, Spanish, Russian, and Chukis. And then there are some more, a lot of them are pretty program specific. The Council for the Homeless came in with several documents that go across a lot of our housing programs. And then each of the agencies came in with multiple documents that they were interested in having translated. So I was kind of surprised at how many documents we got requested from, but I'm really glad. I mean, we were thinking in that $10,000 to $15,000 range to get them translated, and the first bid was $11,000. So it was like, perfect.
Yeah.
So we'll be using the funds for that purpose, which will have a long-lasting effect.
And do we need to be involved at all in the approval of those funds or anything like
that? No, it's such a minor piece of the allocation that we get. And like I said, not enough to do anything. You know, we could add it to an existing program. We can't do anything outside of that. So that's why we decided to do this kind of one-time project and stuff that, especially since we've been hearing from the agencies that it was definitely a need.
So if that bid is $11,000, what do you have in mind with that other $4,000?
So we'll probably just incorporate it, and we have CSBG is nice because it's flexible, mm-hmm. and so it has we have actually 18 months to spend it.
Okay.
And so we can easily put it into the next contracts, which we'll be doing, renewing all of our contracts for next year.
So with all the hurricanes and other crises that have been happening lately, is there a fund that we would want to look at putting a little bit of money into for crisis response for our county?
So the hard part with that, I would have to do some research on. There's other funding that we have that does have crisis response to it. Mm-hmm. The Community Development Block Grant is actually being used heavily right now in Houston, and they're prepping for Florida to be able to use it. It's a disaster recovery. Mm-hmm. CDBG-DR funding, mm-hmm. disaster recovery. So we would easily tap into that funding should we have some sort of disaster here.
Do you know roughly what that dollar amount looks like?
No, every community is different, and it's whatever happens. A few years ago when they had the huge landslide up in Oslo, mm-hmm. they used the disaster recovery funding to go in, and it'll help relocate people and provide housing assistance. It's more flexible in a disaster recovery response than it is for the typical uses of the funds.
So So is that funding held at the state level and then each of the counties?
No, it's a federal.
Okay, so then we would be able to tap into that if we had.
If we had a disaster, we would absolutely.
Evacuate because of the fire.
We would absolutely be tapping into
okay.
it. And actually, Multnomah County is looking at the use of the funds for the small area that got evacuated for the fire.
So that's, I mean, that's totally separate from FEMA funding. And
yes,
like that.
Yes, 100%. It actually works very differently.
Okay.
And CDBG, Disaster Recovery, can provide better and more assistance than FEMA. FEMA is very limited on what they do. And CDBG, they actually come in and they'll be able to do more longer term. So we do have access to disaster recovery funding. And I don't know for sure, but the county has some.
It just seems like if we have little bits of money that come along, if we just kind of threw it in an account like that.
Well, we have to spend it.
Well, we have to spend it.
We have to, yeah. So no matter what, we can't just hold on to the funds. It has to go out within the time frame.
Yeah.
Usually annually, you know, we have an annual allocation and it has to be spent within a year. CSBG is a little more flexible. We have 18 months, but it does. If we don't spend it, we lose it.
Right.
So we can't just pocket it away. But we do have access to other funding that we would use in case of emergency.
So I have a question on the process. Like, I think this is a good idea. It's great to use that sort of money for projects like this. But at what point does that need to come to the advisory group for an okay rather than retroactive? This is what we use the money for. I mean,
so we have to have a request for a proposal at the $50,000 line.
Okay.
And that's when we would bring it to the board.
So anything under $50,000, it's a staff decision.
Yeah, for the most part. And usually, you know, we estimate what our allocations are gonna be. And so normally what happens is if we get a little bit of extra funding, we know it pretty closely to when we're doing the contracts. And so we just, any contracts we weren't able to fund fully, we added into, you know, that last program to bring them a little bit more or as close to whole as possible for their application. This was just kind of, we had no idea this one was happening.
Oh, I'm not arguing with using it for this. I'm just curious that the only time this group has input is in that RFP process.
Or if we saw a significant.
So is there a way to let us know when money like that comes? I mean, you are now, but the decision it sounds like has kind of been made. So is there a way to get any input on any of that dollar amount?
For something as small as $10,000 to $15,000, I wouldn't. And so, because it's such a small amount, but anything that comes up that closer to that $50,000, we would definitely bring it to the board.
I would say that's a huge amount for Central Nonprofits.
Yeah.
And
we can't contract with anyone for less than $40,000. Or it's the cost of doing a contract is not worth for under $40,000. That's why we do a minimum of a $40,000 application request.
It would be neat, you know, thinking along the lines of what Lydia just said about a fund. It would be neat if we explored whether there was a way to create a fund for that where it was feasible to do smaller contracts for one-shot deals. Because what we tend to do here is reinforce existing, and I understand why. Existing organizations and don't see new organizations that may have different focuses. And I know we kind of gamble with federal and state money and there are requirements and it may be that someone else would be a fiscal agent for some seed funding.
And that's where I wonder if lobbying the community foundation to create a small starts. For them to create a small starts program.
Don't they have like a couple of small $5,000 grants?
They did. Yeah, they could be multiple actually.
Maybe we want to partner with them, type.
Pardon?
Maybe we want to partner with them.
Yeah.
I don't know if. Yeah.
the other thing that we want to have to keep in mind, unfortunately for these very small agencies, is that they have to meet, when we're specifically dealing with state and federal funding, they have to meet the fiduciary responsibility that our finance unit has put together, and these very small nonprofits are not going to meet that requirement. So that's another thing that we keep in mind.
So it's fiduciary responsibility,
yeah,
and these state mandated requirements, or Clark County's interpretation of what makes sense?
A combination of both. So they can't, Clark County is, they, to have state or federal funds, they have to have been in business for at least 5 years. They have to have financial policies and procedures in place, or have had an audit, but that an audit doesn't kick in until they've had, I think, $750,000 of funding. So it could, for some of our agencies, they don't even need that. But they have the financial policies and procedures in place. And so that's why we do an administrative review. They're required for state, federal funding, especially federal funding. There's a CFR Part 200 requirements that have risk assessments and guidelines that we have to meet for any type of federal funding that we give to an agency, and they're pretty strict. And so our financial or our fiscal department is very careful on the agencies that they use. So unfortunately, because we have so many federal and state funded funds coming into this group, a lot of it would not be something that we could do to a small startup or an agency that is just, you know, within that 5 years.
Do you accept applications where it's a small agency but they use a larger one as a fiscal agent?
I don't think we've actually had one, but I don't know why we wouldn't.
Yeah.
And so, and when we do our request for application, we get the word out as far and wide as we can, so that those it's not all about notifying our current nonprofits that we work with. It is about getting it into the paper, doing public service announcements, getting it to you guys so you guys can talk to agencies that you know of, and getting it out through our whole stakeholders list, which is far and wide beyond the programs that we fund.
So in that vein, it would help me a bunch. I don't know about other folks, but it would help me to know what those minimum requirements are. Do you have any kind of document that lays out what federal and state and county requirements are for any programs that we fund? I mean, I don't want to go talk to a nonprofit and say, hey, check into funding.
Yeah. Yeah. And then be like, no, I'm sorry, you can't.
Yeah.
But we also, we don't want to discourage small nonprofits either.
Right.
So
do you have anything that would...
We don't have anything now, but let me talk to the fiscal people and see...
It seems like you'd have a checklist to make sure...
We have an administrative review, but we wouldn't put that out to the public because it goes into a lot more, but we could, and it's a little bit more in-depth. But I don't know why we couldn't put together interested in our funding, these are some of the...
That would go right in line with our advocacy.
Yeah.
If we knew a little bit more about what those requirements are,
yeah,
we'd be able to talk, we'd know what we were talking about.
That would to me, that's pretty crucial. I know a couple of small nonprofits that I would love to see get some funding, but I think the only way they could do it is if they could ally with an existing one that is being funded, and that's possible.
Yeah.
But
if we knew
about that,
right,
would be something that maybe we could afford some guidance to people.
I can talk to our fiscal.
I wouldn't mind looking at the administrative review document. I don't think we want to put it out, but
yeah.
I don't know if I'm allowed to put it out. It's an internal use document. So I can
a public records request.
That always works.
That always works.
But if you could talk to them and just see if, maybe just to the board, if we would be able to get some type of a checklist, I think that would be
Definitely. I think that was something that we could definitely put together. Because we have a brochure that talks about what the CAB is. We could create a brochure or add to that brochure, modify it somehow to say, you know, are you interested in applying for funds? And
if you do,
this is like every, you know, it's an every 3 year process. And
but here's the checklist. Here's the basic minimum requirements that you'd have to do as a nonprofit in order to apply.
Can't have any bankruptcies or legal pending legal actions.
But all of that stuff would be great for them to know.
Yeah.
Before they go through the process of applying.
Yeah.
Then we get new blood in. Yeah, I think that'd be cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the things. That's why we make sure we advertise and get those public service announcements out and try to get as far and wide as so that we know a lot of the agencies that are here in Clark County. We obviously aren't working with every single one. We obviously don't have enough money to work with every single one.
Right.
But
yeah. Cool. Awesome. Thank you.
At the federal level, just an update, David Bradley, who is the CEO of the National Community Action Foundation, he came, sent an email a couple weeks ago saying, you know, things are very in flux. They put in the Senate put in their proposal to fully fund at the same level as last year, so now we're waiting for the House and their proposal. We all know Trump zeroed out the funding, but he said in his email he talked about how there's a lot of very strong support from both sides of the aisle for community services block grant funding, and so he feels pretty strongly that we'll have pretty steady funds coming in for the next allocation. We also, I just heard yesterday that with the disaster recovery funding approval by Congress, they put in a continuing resolution. So that will go until December 8th. So the federal government will be funded at least until December 8th.
Oh, nice. Hey, anything else?
Legislatively.
So, you can look at our really cool graphic here. Very cool.
So, this is an extreme draft version of the community needs assessment. It does not have all of the information in it. Staff has been extremely busy, unfortunately, we haven't been able to put full focus into getting this for you. Some things that I wanted to bring or just kind of let you know about this is that don't pay attention to formatting or anything like that, because this document is going to go to our communications department and they are going to be the ones that put it together. So right now we're just working on content. And then even the content is going to change, because that's what communications does. They read it and they change all the wording. Sometimes it's good, sometimes not so much.
Will we have a chance to look at it after they do their
So, yes. My goal is that I will have all the components in this by September 26th. Then I will send it over to communications, and then they will start working on it, and that will give, I have a deadline for them to get it back to me at near the end of October. I needed a solid month for back and forth, because there will be lots of back and forth. It's a large document.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll have a draft or a final version, essentially, to bring to you guys. And then any minor changes I'll need to know before we meet. You'll have about a week to review before, and then we have to adopt it at the November meeting. So my plan is to get it to you guys 2 weeks before our meeting with any comments back to me by the week before our meeting, so that I can do any final changes and bring you that completed document at the November meeting. So what you have in front of you today is a really good representation of what's going to be in here. And I've done some work since the task force.
Oh, it's beautiful. What we had asked was that the Portland, Vancouver, Metro MSA numbers be there, because we're part of them and it's larger.
Yes. You should see my spreadsheet, because
I'm impressed.
The census data, of this information, their MSA data was older. They haven't kept it up to date. And so I literally went in and pulled, there's six counties that make up the Metropolitan Statistical Area. And for each one of these, I pulled that information and then I averaged it out so that we had the information to go into this report. So I came in on Labor Day for 5 hours.
Whoops.
It is Labor Day for a reason, right? to get this information, because we agreed that, you know, because we're a border city or a border region, it was important to have that information in there. So I sacrificed for you guys. I just want you to know. some other things, so you'll see that when you're looking at the tables, you're going to have information for Clark County because that's our region. You'll have for the Portland-Vancouver, it's called the Portland-Vancouver-Beaverton MSA. I don't know why, but it is six counties. So it's Skamania and Clark in Washington. And then it's Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas.
Yeah. That would be too far
away. I think I wrote it in here somewhere. Yes. So Multnomah, Clackamas, Columbia, Washington, and Yamhill in Oregon.
Okay.
So I guess that's seven counties. I have to learn how to count. So, and then we wanted to compare it to Washington State, to how we're doing versus Washington State and versus the nation. So you're going to, this is very data heavy, which it should be as an assessment. I also, do you like the new map that I had? So on page 7, I had this wonky map in there that was really just overloaded with information. I went back to our GIS and I had them create this. We wanted to give a sense of what was rural versus what are urban areas, and this is what they were able to come up with. So it's not as clear as I was hoping it would be, but it's much better than what I had in there before. Mm-hmm.
What did these things say?
And the graphic itself is not clear at all, and I apologize. It was me sticking it. Yeah, it's me sticking it in here. When the PIO, the communications department, gets this, they will have a much cleaner, they have all the graphic software, and so they'll get it in there and it'll be beautiful. We have some economic activity. I have emails in to Scott Bailey and to Lori, I forgot her last name, she's with the Department of Social, no, DSHS, Department of
Health and Department of Social and Health Services.
Social and Human Services. I'm going to go by the acronym, sorry. I have emails into both of them to kind of get a better clarity of some of the data that's in here, so I'm waiting for their responses. But we wanted to give an idea of the economic activity that's going on here in Clark County. The demographics section that starts on page 10 is quite a bit of information. So on those tables, you'll see Clark County as a whole, Clark County below the poverty level, the MSA totals, MSA below poverty, and then versus Washington and the state. So you get a lot of comparable data for those areas. We will beef up all of the content that talks about these tables. So there's little descriptions in there now, but we want to beef those up a little bit more to get a little bit more descriptive. And that's the same for the Clark County Survey of Needs demographics that starts on page 13. There's no context there at this point. I just threw all those charts in there that we've seen for a year now. So we want to give some more context to those so it's not just charts.
One thing on that, I think it's most of those charts. The first one has percentages at the top of the bar charts. The rest are straight numbers.
On which one?
What is your race? The bar chart is as of
page
13. Page 13.
Those are all percentages?
Right, and they list them at the top. The next one,
oh,
it's numbers, and the same on page 14. They're mostly numbers. It might be nice to be consistent with the percentages. I'd rather have percentages because you get an idea of the numbers from
numbers for everything else except for that one. Any other feedback for that section?
So guys, we're way ahead of schedule and Amy isn't here yet to present, so we literally have like 20 minutes to discuss this.
She'll be early. She
so,
knows to be early,
okay.
But yeah.
Okay.
I have to leave a little
bit. I have to leave a little bit for the conference.
So maybe we can move on and talk about the January meeting.
Yeah, we can move on to other stuff.
Well, is there other, I don't want to rush anyone. If
no,
they,
no.
Sure.
I have a sort of stupid question, but it's because I knew. Who's our target audience for this report? Who does the report go to?
So it's going out to the community. So we are going to actually bring this to in front of city and county council, and it's for us to use internally for policy and funding decisions. It'll be used by this board for funding decisions. And then we're going to get it out to all of the nonprofits specifically. I actually have a huge list of interested community members who've attended forums and things like that that would like it specifically, email the copy. But it's to get out to all other funders. In the executive summary, when you have a chance to actually read through it, it talks a little bit more about what our use, what we hope this will be used for. We would love the Community Foundation of Southwest Washington to read this and help with their funding decisions, and we want it to be used. It's a process that we've been doing for a year and a half now, a little over a year, and so we want to make sure that it doesn't just get put on the shelf. We want it to be used to help with funding decisions for nonprofits to put with their funding applications and
I've used our community needs assessments in the past, parts of it, for grants that we've gone after in the district, and so it is something that
yeah.
we use.
Yeah. The on page 16, the blankest section of the entire report is the causes and conditions of poverty in Clark County. This is a very important section. This, we are waiting for those emails from Lori and Scott Bailey so that we can really dig into this section. And then after that, we go in and the structure of the report is broken down just like we did for the survey. So it's by domain or by category. So housing, employment, education. We put them in order of need. So housing is the highest need and it's the first topic that's discussed. So I'll go over what we've included in each of these sections, but I'll just focus on the housing section so you can see how all of these sections are really laid out. First, you have discussion of the survey of needs, and there's a chart there.
Page 17,
moving into 18. The chart is actually on page 18. So each of the sections has their chart about what the needs were through the survey of needs, what was identified as their top needs. Then we have the forum group discussion that we had back on May 18th. This is really just bullet points right now, but we will actually make it into sentences more legible, not just bullet points, but we wanted you to know that this will be discussed. The information we gleaned out of the forum that we did will be in this. And then there's this other assessment summary, and what we've done is we've taken a look at all of these different assessments that have been throughout the community by different agencies like public health or Council for the Homeless and things like that, and we have taken a look at them. And so we're kind of gleaning from there what their conclusions were and including that discussion as it pertains to that category. We also have a personal journey story in each of the domains. And so they're not necessarily a success story because they may not have reached that success yet, but this is something particular to that category. And it's a true story from that we received from our different partner agencies. We've asked them to bring this back. And not only just the ones we funded, like there's Lifeline and other agencies that we partner with that provided us with information. And then the last section.
Before we move on.
Yeah.
On page 23.
You're way ahead.
No, you were going first. Oh, sorry.
No, you're fine with your question. You're just in another section. It's fine.
I'll wait.
What's your question?
It was on page 23. It says other assessment summary.
Uh-huh.
And since I was way ahead, I probably got the wrong one. But you went to outside sources for different service. They've done their own sort of but
what if there's so like the healthy youth
yeah.
survey
so
or
we have a list of all those at the back. I mean they're not footnoted or referenced in the piece. In a way that somebody could go check.
No, that's good. Michael just started working on this section of it, and so you'll notice in other pieces where I have it italicized, like but that's where I got my data from.
Yeah.
Which we will have a bibliography. It won't be in the section. It will be a bibliography at the end.
Yeah.
So yes, thank you for noting
yeah,
that, and I will.
I think nonprofits use this during their own grants. If you want to cite the original.
No, I 100%
right.
agree.
Sort of like,
yeah. Yes.
That's
it's stealing. Yeah, no, it's not cheating, it's stealing. Info. Definitely. We'll make sure that that's in there. And then each section will have, when we did our forum, when we did our data walk, we pulled in additional information to kind of support those. So for housing, we have the point in time count trend. And so we'll make sure we pull stuff like that into this community needs assessment. We already collected the data. We should as might as well put it into the report, right? So make sure we get lots of use out of it. And we'll add contextual information also there. It's not going to be a chart just floating there.
So we talk about a lot of the more detailed stuff closer to the front, but the actual overview of needs is way in the back.
Yes.
Is there any way to get that closer to the front?
So it's because of the way we ask the questions in the survey. The overview of needs is, we put it at the end of the other, the domains are what are important, because that's going to break it down. What do we need under housing? So we know we need housing assistance. What is in there, and we wanted to focus on those. Then we get to the overview of needs, and it's just a highlight of the main categories of need.
It just seems, I mean, seriously, I just had to like search and search and search to find that. Just seems like, I mean, I don't know, anytime I've done a college paper or anything, I kind of put the big picture at the front and then the detailed stuff. So I would just.
They're on separate basis.
Yeah.
They're not apples to oranges, and the stuff at the back does not lead to the stuff at the front.
Okay.
So we spent our subcommittee spent a lot of time.
Okay.
Going through it and
okay.
Because we raised the same thing.
Okay.
Gosh, why
okay.
is this the back?
Right.
And so finally came to agree.
It's more supplemental to. The first part of this really the more in-depth information.
Mm-hmm.
But there is the executive summary
mm-hmm.
that talks.
Right.
I mean, it pulls everything in and you can get a lot of information out of that executive summary.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. I mean, as Kai explained.
On that,
mm-hmm.
probably it's sort of easier to see it.
Mm-hmm.
A different format.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be completely,
easier.
It's going to look
okay.
so, it's not going to look anything like what you have right in front of you.
Okay.
This is just to get
the. Except I'm sort of like the cover page.
I know.
I think that is so cool.
the next section is the overview of needs. And this is from the one question we asked, rank your top five
right.
needs.
Right.
And the chart that's with that, it was put together by the consultant that we use, which is a nice little comparison between different populations and their needs. Then the last part is to talk about our partner participation. I listed out everybody we work with to get those surveys out. And what I need to focus now on is all of the presentations that we did in the community to all of the city councils, to a lot of the community groups. And things like that. So this will actually grow itself to see that all the partners that we brought to the table as we were working our way through doing this community needs assessment. And then we have our exhibits. And so these will be attached in there. So they'll have a copy of the survey. We're going to have a link to the raw data. So the raw data will be available on our website and agencies will be able to download it and play with it. So it's just one huge Excel spreadsheet, so you guys can have fun with it, but it's there. And so if you want to look at specific populations, you could sort and figure some of that information out. We'll have all of the group discussion notes from the forum that we did, and then a lot of this information, those tables in the front, the demographics and things like that, were pulled from the Community Commons report, so we will have a link to that report because they did put quite a bit of information, and we'll have the full bibliography from all of the information. So this report is right now 40 pages, and I anticipate it to double. And then we'll see what communications does to it. So.
My only comment on that is, if you get an 80-page document, how many people do you think, outside the ones who use the information, how many do you think will really look at it?
They'll look at the executive summary. And that's why it's important to have an executive summary that really sums up all of the information that's inside.
I think you're probably right. I think it's going to get that information out. It almost seems like you need a one-pager or a trifold to go out that summarizes it, so if they want more information, they can access this rather than, of course, it'll be online, right?
It'll be a lot of nonprofits.
It'll be online, right? Yeah. And then I've already been requested to come and do presentations on it once we've completed it, so I'll be putting together a presentation that will, as I like to say, take on the road, so we'll have it broken down.
So can CAB support you in any of that kind of work?
In doing the presentations?
Or helping get us into, I mean, that just isn't right in line with our advocacy piece and getting the word out.
I mean, if you hear of anybody that's interested in having presentations done and stuff, I'm happy to get it in the schedule. Once we're done with this, not completely caught up. I won't ever be completely caught up, but having Kelly on board and getting, this has been the project of the year, so.
Then you can take a vacation.
I
don't.
No,
not come in on Labor Day.
Yes.
Wow. Wow. An incredible amount of work, so thank you to Rebecca, and thank you to the
If there's anything else that you feel like is just completely missing out of this, then please let me know as I'm, you know, looking through, you know, the task force came back and they really wanted that MSA information, so we made it happen. Mm-hmm. We will do the best that we can to get the information that should be sent out.
So good work, Rebecca, and good work, task force, for putting it all together and mm-hmm. compiling it in a way that makes sense to everyone. Any other comments or suggestions? Okay. So let's move on then. Rebecca, can you help us with the April-June funding outcome?
Yes, so that's our big report. This is the one that we collect quarterly from our nonprofits. You'll be able to see Amy. It does. We do take your reports and we do something with them.
I'm
we want
so
to thank you. So what we did, so this is for the first quarter of 2017. No, it's the second quarter of 2017. So you'll see that there's the 2016 totals, so that is for the full calendar year 2016, and we have this 2017 spent to date. Everybody is pretty much on track. I'm not sure what's going on with SOAR, why they haven't spent out any of their funding, but they do tend to wait and only bill us every few months, so I'm assuming that's what's happening there. I'm not sure.
Which one is that?
That is the fourth one down.
Oh,
it's Community Services Northwest SOAR. They reported they have outcomes. They just haven't billed us for them yet. So we're sure we'll get a bill from them eventually.
Well, sorry.
Go ahead.
What's SOAR?
SOAR is the SSI-SSDI Outreach, Access, and Recovery. So it's a program specific to help people who are chronically homeless.
So this pays for Jimmy.
What?
Is this paid for Jimmy's?
Jamie. No, not Jamie. It pays for Suzanne's job. She oversees the SOAR program.
Is that sure it has zero? Is it just empty? In that
yes.
Month? I think they've spent, I just didn't have the June yet.
Oh, okay.
So I just didn't ever update that. So they have spent.
So we'll make sure it gets updated. I'm not worried about that at this point. I know as long as they're getting some outcomes, that's what's important. impact in their permanent supportive housing is spent out only about half of what their funding is, and they've come to us and they've been asking us about their contracts and the amounts that they have, and so we're in discussions with them. We want them to make sure that they focus on permanent supported housing programs for that. Are there any questions on the first two pages?
So you just mentioned Impact Northwest. So they have two funding streams, one's 91%.
The Rapid Rehousing Program, yes.
So they're going to run out of money?
They've requested their permanent supportive housing go into rapid rehousing. However, we would prefer that they focus on permanent supported housing.
Okay.
I want to understand why. Why are they struggling to spend the money on permanent supportive housing? Why is it so much easier for them to spend on rapid rehousing? Yeah.
Well, rapid rehousing, you can cycle people through the program faster because it is a light touch. People come in and you can go get them into housing, work through their barriers, and you know, they don't have as many barriers. And so then you can do that type of service. Permanent supportive housing, they tend typically have much higher barriers, so they're harder to work with, harder to get into housing specifically. So they may be doing a lot of case management, but not be able to get into an actual housing unit to pay for the rent.
Mm-hmm. And that's where we have a number of issues.
Well, all of our programs have issues trying to find landlords.
And the outcomes are measured over a year rather than 30 days.
With the consolidated homeless grant, I mentioned we have we've received new contracts or new allocations from Commerce. And so Impact Northwest for their TANF Rapid Rehousing Program, and then SHARE for the Housing and Essential Needs and the Aspire Permanent Supported Housing programs are getting new contracts that align better with Commerce's fiscal year of July 1 through June 30 rather than our calendar year. So staff right now is actually talking about changing our fiscal years. So instead of being on a calendar year, aligning more with the Consolidated Homeless Grant, Emergency Solutions Grant, and the Community Service Block Grant funding. They are all on that July 1 through June 30 timeframe. So we're talking about adjusting hours to align better so that we aren't doing closeouts every 6 months, and gives our agencies the better understanding of that you're actually closing out. Right now we have contracts that have the contract doesn't end until December, but you have to spend out all of this money by June, the end of June, and it's a little confusing. Commerce just recently switched over to a fiscal year. And so they used to be on a calendar year. It worked out great. Then they switched to a fiscal year for some of their funds, but not all of their funds. Now everything's on a fiscal year. And so staff are working to make that change.
So does that mean people are under the current contract that expires in end of December, and you're rewriting contracts to go to next June?
So, well, we're talking about it.
Yeah.
And so what it would do is it would we would adjust the RFA process. So we might push it out just a little bit, extend contracts for 6 months, and then be in line. We haven't made that final decision, but that's where we're heading.
And that will change when the RFAs go up for new funding?
By just a couple of months.
And we know how much money is going to come in. We currently know what the money is for June. You say we spread it to December, but they have to spend it out in June.
our current contracts. So what we've done in our current contracts is we know they have money through June and they have to spend that column out. And then we're estimating for that, the rest of it, because we don't have that next allocation.
So now we'll be estimating, if we rewrite the contracts, we'll be estimating to next June.
We'll know because of the allocation.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll know. We'll, finance will have a better understanding of what actual amount of dollars we have, and so we won't be guessing as much, and it will put us in line with what their fiscal year is. So it'll make it a lot easier for all of the programs.
Sounds just like trying to write a school budget.
If Commerce would just stop changing their fiscal year, it would be really helpful.
Are very much like it.
And our major report is October 1 through September 30th. So it's not even on the same timeline. So it's
all.
Oh, yeah. It's trying to keep all of the different timelines in mind. Amy knows. She gets all of the different funding.
Let's make it as complicated as we can.
And so we're trying to undo all of that complication. Because the HEN program is run strictly by share, they have their new contract will be a 2-year contract, and we just won't touch it. And we've been for 2 years, and they won't have to worry about it because that's what Commerce is giving to us. So that is easy. So you'll see some changes coming up, and we'll talk more as we get closer and as staff really figures out how this is going to work and is it going to make the best sense for all of our programs. You know, we will do the extra work to make it not as complicated for the different programs because that's important.
So,
we have an understanding what's going on.
I only ask this because it's 100% share and it's a large amount of money, and we're not going to look at that for 2 years. But are those the only two outcomes you mentioned?
So, the HEN program, no. We.
Is the underlying data. You know, is this a summary of a whole bunch of measures that define what housing stability is?
So there are multiple, the HEN program does not do a standard quarterly report like all of the other programs. And so I would rather let Amy explain it, because it used to go straight to share from Commerce, and then Commerce decided that they didn't want to have so many contracts. So then they said, hey, it has to go through a county. And so all we do is kind of, you know, push the money out to share.
But it is different than a lot of other contracts. When they originally set it up, they had it where you weren't supposed to do any case management. They wanted it to look more like what DSHS does.
Yeah.
So then you would have a caseload of 165 people. You pretty much check that they have a pulse to move forward. Surprisingly, that really doesn't help clients with stability. So, you know, over time, they being the Department of Commerce, has backed down from that, and I'm like, hey, we really need you to work on having a housing stability with people, and especially focus on people who are literally homeless, and don't just put them in a home and tool off, like provide them with additional services.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of additional performance measures, they haven't really gotten to that point. They do define what a housing stability plan is, and then the county will come out and look. Okay, you created this stability plan. You have to reassess people every 90 days. Are they still going to be homeless but for this assistance? Did you do that? Did they show any progress? Like, so they come out and they look at the notes to be sure that we're actively working with people. But in terms of the things that you get to look at for measuring, they are pretty small. And the number of people served are extremely high.
Yeah.
So it's our biggest single contract. And the most people that we have served under one program.
What's the caseload like?
Right now it's about 250, and that's low. Well, I mean, caseload of like everybody that we have served, and that's low. It's just that every year the state looks at whether or not they're going to cut this program. And this year, like the past two bienniums, the state went right up until June 30th to make their budget decisions.
Right.
So that meant that we couldn't add anybody onto the program at all. You know, the last 6 months of the year, not knowing what the state was going to do.
Right.
So usually that number would be higher.
Yeah, so the HEN program is very, it's its own little caveat program. And so all of the other programs that go through Commerce or locally, we have more outcomes, and that's why we have more stuff to report.
And then the Community Services Block Grant Innovation Grant is done. It's completed and closed out, and actually Cher went through it to become a trauma-informed agency. They're working through the process of carrying that on throughout the agency, so they've had multiple people in the agency do the training. They'll carry it on to the full agency itself, along with working with the Washington Gorge Community Action Agency and Lower Columbia Community Action Agency. It was a tri-community action program. Mm-hmm. Is that, sounds weird.
Excellent.
Any other questions?
Any other
questions, comments?
All right. Well, we've seen Cher a whole bunch on here. We talked about them a whole bunch. They're an amazing program, and we're going to hear from their director, Amy Reynolds. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning, Amy. Or not.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. As long as you can see. So you're going to see a variety of housing programs, and you might think to yourself, why in the world do we need so many housing programs? Well, in 2013, specifically August of 2013, the average rent, according to Rent Jungle, for a one-bedroom apartment was $785. The average price for a two-bedroom apartment was $871. In August of 2017, the average price for a one-bedroom is $1,422, and for a two-bedroom, $1,757. So things have changed. And we're really finding that our clients are having a difficult time maintaining that housing. So even if they get support to help move in, they're moving into an apartment that we can't pay $1,400. Like, we are structured by government funding, so that means the top amount that we could pay for one, like, letting out the utility allowance would be $1,021. So our clients don't live in the average apartment. They live in an apartment based on what we can afford to pay. So they're not very competitive in the market, but even if we can get them into an apartment, it's difficult for them to maintain that without a subsidy. Mm-hmm. Minimum wage has gone up considerably in the state, and it's going to continue to do that. What used to be like $9.47, now it's $11 an hour. It'll be $11.50 next year, $12.50, $13. It'll be fairly high, but it's still not competing with the rents. So the subsidies, sadly, are really needed. So we have a multitude of programs which are largely funded by the county. One of them is prevention. Prevention is usually the most sought after funds in the community. People call the city, people call the county, running behind on their rents and being afraid that they're going to lose their housing, that they're going to have to move into their car. So there are two categories of prevention when we're talking about government money, that people who are at risk of losing their homes, and these are people who usually have a 3-day pay or vacate, where their landlord has said, you're running behind on your rent, you have 3 days to get it together and at least start making payments, or we're going to ask you to leave. Or for people who are couch surfing, so they're doubled up. They're staying with friends or family, and a lot of time their friends or family are also renting, so they can't really stay there for any period of time, or they're making their friends' housing unstable. Their landlord is going to ask them to leave. So we have prevention funds. To access prevention funds, like pretty much all of our programs, except for him, you go through the Council for the Homeless, so they are the front door for services. So that means that anybody who is seeking housing services contacts the Council for the Homeless. Prevention is different than pretty much everything else that comes through their doors because it's so sought after, and every agency that has tried to run this feels really overwhelmed that you get 300 phone calls for what amounts to one household's worth of money that you have available. So we rarely ever have an opening in this program, but when we do, the system works that we contact the council. So on an average day, if you were to contact the Council for the Homeless and say, I'm running behind on my rent, I need some help, they would say, I'm so sorry, there isn't funding available. You can reach out to faith-based communities, but there's no funding available. When we have an opening, we contact the Council for the Homeless, and on that particular day, they would say, great, tell me more about your situation. Great's not really the best word. I could help. And it's not, there are so many people seeking prevention help. It's not just for, you're running behind on your rent, great, we can help. It's more, you're running behind on your rent,
let's talk about what else is going on, and then it's really targeted for, have you ever been homeless before? Do you have a chronic health condition? Are you struggling with domestic violence? So it's targeted prevention for those people who are most likely to become homeless. And that's actually research-based, that while there's a lot of people who are excited around doing something around prevention, thinking that if you could try to stop the flow on one side of the spigot, then you could really solve the problem down the way, research has shown that most people who are struggling are really unlikely to slip into homelessness. Usually, you can figure it out. If people spoke to their landlord, you can make a payment plan. They actually don't usually want to evict their tenants. It's very expensive for a landlord. You have to do the turnover. It's a big pain. They would rather, usually, keep their tenant. If they're a good tenant, they're not much of a bother. It's less expensive for them to do that. So they can often work it out. However, for people who have slipped into homelessness before, are struggling with a chronic health issue, Kate Butt from the council has often spoken about how she could set up a shelter just for people who have cancer. You are probably going to slip into homelessness. The other thing that happens with this is that you have to be reassessed after 90 days. So with prevention assistance, you might think, well, that's just one-time help, and you help them pay their rents, you talk to them about budgeting, kind of figure out, are they going to be stable, and then you help them fly. But we work with people who are really close to the edge. So 30% of the area median income means that a family of four makes, what is it, $24,600 gross. So that is very close to the edge. So the idea that they would be completely comfortable with paying their rent the second month, probably not so good. Our work is not necessarily to make people comfortable, but to make that possible for them to be able to stay in that unit. So that's around, what other expenses do you have? What else can you pay? And how can we help you focus on paying your rent first? But every 90 days, people have to be reassessed of, okay, are you still in this situation? Do you still need help? We understand it's not comfortable for you to pay your rent, but looking at your funds, can you do that? And if they can, then we're going to back away. The prevention funds that we have through the county allows us to also reengage. So 90 days, looks like you're going to be fine. You've managed to increase your income. You've settled your past debt with your landlord. You're good to go. We're going to back away. But 6 months later, you experience a crisis. You have a mental issue. You have a job loss. We can step back in, try to help keep you housed. So it's going to be intermittent and help. So far this year, we've served 133 people. 33 in families, which includes 61 kids and 17 adults. And of those folks, 46 people have exited, and 94% exited into permanent housing.
Yeah.
It's okay. I don't mind knowing this.
Sorry, Nancy. You look at these numbers, you're like, wow, that's amazing. We do also keep 2-year numbers, so I don't want to, rain on the parade here, but we do keep 2-year numbers with the idea of, okay, so this is how people exited from us, but 2 years down the way, any time in the next 2 years down the way, did something else happen that we weren't able to help, and did they eventually slip into homelessness? So 2 years from now, you're going to be checking back in with these people, and you'll find out, did it hold? You know, when they left, they were housed. And you often see amazing numbers out of prevention, which is the other reason why people are like, yay, I want to spend a lot of money on that, but it's more amazing when we're able to keep people housed who've had those additional risk factors who are really likely to be able to become literally homeless. So the other big pot of funds that people look at, so there's prevention, people who are either housed or they're staying with friends or family, but they were at least somewhat safe. And then there's rapid rehousing dollars that are used to serve people who are literally homeless. And by that we mean people are sleeping in their cars, under parks, under bridges, around share house. People who are currently sleeping in shelters, these folks need rapid rehousing. Rapid rehousing through the Council of the Homeless. So the way that works is you call, you let them know their situation, and they would put you into a priority pool. There are currently, a priority pool isn't a wait list, so it's not that if Rebecca calls first and Ty calls second, then Rebecca's the next one up to get funding. It's that if Rebecca has a family of three and they're staying in their car and Ty is by himself and has a chronic medical issue, Ty's first. So it's just kind of looking at the different risk factors that people are experiencing, and you go into this pool. Currently in the pool, There are 543 individuals, 301 families, for a total of 844 households that are hoping to be able to access funds. Sorry, like this is all going to be like kind of a combination of like upper and downer. So these folks have to be reassessed every 90 days. So the idea of rapid rehousing is that it's a different model. It came out of stimulus funding from the days of HPRP and the recession, that we would look at doing programs differently. The traditional transitional housing model of we're going to provide funds for people living in poverty who need additional assistance for up to 2 years is one method of doing things. But this is, we're going to provide funds for people living in poverty to be able to access housing through a progressive engagement model, which would not necessarily mean that, well, we could serve them for up to 24 months. It wouldn't necessarily mean that we would. Progressive engagement means that we would work with the client to use as little money as possible to get them housed and keep them housed. So that might mean paying their rent for 3 months and then providing case management for an additional 3 months. It might mean paying their rents and working on budgeting and helping them increase their income for 4 months. It just depends on what their needs are. Yes?
Considering you've almost spent all that money for rapid rehousing, what happens then?
They're going to do any fan to run around. No, so let's see. Our funds, yeah, what happens then is we can only serve the people that we have on the program until the dollars run out. So rapid rehousing is a really interesting funding game because people can reaccess. So with other funding, you figure, well, okay, we have X amount of money based on an average rent, which is right now of our portion that we pay is about $750. So then the client usually pays the rest. Most of our clients have some income. And you'd say, well, we could serve about 20 households with that money. But because it's intermittent, we might serve a household for 3 months, and then we have an opening. And then we need to find somebody to house them, and it took us 3 months to be able to house them because they had a lot of issues. So in which case, now we had more money than we expected, and then we have to scramble to house somebody else. But that other guy who we let off the program wanted to come back in, so it's always like a game to try to figure out how we can properly account for the money. But it means that we wouldn't add any more people to the program. We just work with what we have with everything we can until we're out.
So you still provide a lot of the case management and things, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even though you don't have the dollars to actually pay the rent, you're still working with families. Yeah.
Absolutely true. But you know, usually what's the biggest carrot and your biggest influence of being able to work with a household is paying their rent. Yeah. So far this year we've served 74 people, and 21 of those were people in families. And of the 55 who exited, 78% left to stability, so not as good as prevention. Something that we're continuing to work on. You guys were talking earlier about permanent supportive housing. So these other programs, when you call the Council for the Homeless, they put you through what's called the VI SPDAT, and it's a vulnerability index where they try to figure out, based on your needs and your family dynamics, where are you in the spectrum of needs of services? Are you rapid rehousing, where maybe we can help you with brief assistance? There's transitional housing, where maybe we can help you with 2 years worth of assistance. And there's permanent supportive housing, in which case you're chronically homeless, so you've been homeless three to four times over the course of a year or for a year or more, and you have a debilitating condition, or somebody in your immediate family has a debilitating condition, in which case you can receive assistance indefinitely. You accessed us through the Council for the Homeless. There's the VI SPDAT, the Vulnerability Index, and then there's also the VAT, the Vulnerability Assessment Tool. And this is an evidence-based research tool that was created by DESC out of Seattle to look for the people who are most likely to die on the streets. So these two tools are used for this program. And then people are reassessed every 5 years, because even though they were put into a program that says we could pay for you indefinitely, we really want to make sure that the people who are still on this program are high need, because they're also receiving case management sometimes once a week, sometimes three times a week. And if they don't need that, if they're just living in poverty, a lot of people on this program are on SSI.
get SSI, you get $771 a month, which, as you heard from that, doesn't get you a one-bedroom apartment. It might get you a room in a house, or it gets you a place with subsidized housing. So that's the part that we're looking to figure out with that 5 years, which, do you really need intensive case management, or do you actually just need a Section 8 voucher from the Housing Authority, and maybe we can transfer you to a more low-budget experience? Currently serves 19 people through that program, and that's 3 families, with 9 of those being kids, and 7 singles. And nobody has exited this year, and that's a performance goal for this, that we want to keep people housed and people were unlikely to exit. So we have some other scattered site housing first programs that use specifically the VAT. Scattered site means that they don't necessarily live in one particular place. They can live anywhere in the community. What's become the most affordable places to live in Clark County is usually Washougal. It's still a lot more affordable to live there than it is in downtown Vancouver. And since our clients are really high need on this program, as in they don't usually have a poor credit history, they may have a criminal history, but if so, it's usually minor infractions, probably brokenness, something minor, not usually a person-to-person crime. But they haven't had a rental history for the past 10 to 20 years because they've been living on the streets. So that's the part that is usually the biggest deterrent to a landlord, and they often have zero income or just Social Security also a deterrent to a landlord. So it's really a relationship-building process to get people housed in this program. People are assessed through the VAT score, that vulnerability assessment tool, which looks at your mental health, your substance abuse, your physical health issues, and gives you a score for some of these things. And the more concerns you have, the bigger your score, the people with the biggest scores get in. And then a list of eligible people is held at the council. So people who do these VATs are SHARE, the Council for the Homeless, Community Services Northwest, Impact Northwest. So they all are trained in this 2-day training to do these VATs. And then all of those scores go to the council where they're reassessed so that a particular outreach worker doesn't feel like, I have a real relationship with this person and I want this person to move into housing. So the council relooks at these to be sure that people are grading similarly so that the people that we put in are really most likely to need it. And it's a very small program. We currently serve 4 people in that program, and it's about half. It's 2 men and 2 women, and they're all over 50, all chronically homeless, and once again, nobody has exited this year. And then with this program, actually some of the funds were used to support people in other permanent supportive housing programs, so that meant that we developed a relationship with ALSA, which is a state-run program and has had a focus this year on moving people out of Western State Hospital. Most of our clients don't move into Western State Hospital, like you really have to have a lot of mental health issues to move in. And then some of them have been in there for 10 years. The client was in there for 10 years, and when they first exited, they needed to access housing. We were able to find them housing, but their rental supports didn't kick in for 2 months, and we were able to use some of these fundings to get them housed right away, until we could get their funding to prove. Lincoln Place. Lincoln Place is a site-based housing first, permanent supportive housing program. The difference between site-based and scattered site is that it is at one particular building. This particular building is across the street from Share House, and it was specifically designed to serve people, to serve this particular population. Lincoln Place is a partnership. It's a partnership with the Vancouver Housing Authority. They own the building. As partnership with SHARE, we provide services. Key Properties manages the building. And then Community Services Northwest provides services on site. They provide mental health and substance abuse services on site, both with a substance abuse service gentleman who's there for 40 hours a week. And then they have the PAC team that comes in and works with specific clients, provide them individual services. They have a psychiatrist that they bring out on site to be able to work with people and provide medications. And then they're hoping to have a behavioral health specialist hopefully in the next week or so who would also work with the staff around interventions with people with chronic mental health and substance abuse issues. And like I said, this house, the housing is designed to serve the most vulnerable, most likely to die on the street.
contrast who goes into Lincoln Place versus who just goes into Scatter Site?
Nope, they're the same. And in fact, more than half of the people that originally moved into Lincoln Place had been living in Scattered Sites, and that hadn't worked out. So, and then some of the people who have lived at Lincoln Place have exited to Scattered Sites. It's just been a matter of, so we didn't originally have a site-based program, so our only option was Scattered Site. So then we had the first 17 were people who had flowed out. They've been in private market housing and had been exited usually about three different times due to a variety of issues. One of them was having a lot of guests. That's a common problem with people who've been living on the streets for a long time, is they have a lot of foot traffic, which can be really uncomfortable by a lot. So you can find 10 people have moved into an apartment that was designed for one. Landlords, that's a definite no-no. So it's been unit condition, trying to help people keep their unit in a reasonable state, also been a major factor for folks. And then for people living at Lincoln Place, you're also living with 29 other people who are struggling. And some of the people do that very quietly and are very introverted. And some people are hearing voices and having conversations with people that aren't there. And if you are experiencing a lot of anxiety, that can be really upsetting for you. So that it's been like, okay, like we moved you into this setting, you've been here for a while, but that isn't working out, let's try it in the other setting so you're still high need. For places like DESC up in Seattle, they have 1,000 units of housing first, so they're able to do that continuously with people. They have amazing success rates out of this program, like 90-95%, and it's part of that that it isn't that you move somebody into one unit and they became so incredibly healthy that they were able to stay in that unit forever, but you were able to move them to other units without them having an experience of homelessness. So, yeah, they're not currently different people. They're just living in different places. So there are 30 singles who live there, and it's nearly evenly divided between men and women. I guess I just keep bringing up this statistic because I find it to be really interesting, but the people that you see living on the streets are often men, and that's kind of who people envision are who would be in the most need of this program, but we see a lot of women. And usually with women, it's been a lot of mental health issues, and sometimes that's combined with substance abuse issues. Yeah. And in a year's time, we had 7 leave with a 76% success rate. Since that time, we've had others leave, but we were able to fill in those 7 that left, so it's been about 76% success rate that we've sustained.
So there's no time limit. Somebody could stay there as long as necessary.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's true of all of our permanent supportive housing programs, that they could live there indefinitely.
When they leave, is that you're assuming they're just back on the street?
So we want to know about when they leave. So let's, our first gentleman who moved out of there left within a month. He left voluntarily. He had a lot of anxiety and believed that people were coming into his room and removing things. There are 30 units in that building. There are 30 cameras in that building. None of them are in the units, but they're in the halls. They're in the common areas. And so we tried to show to him, like, look, you can watch this for hours. There's nobody coming in and out of your unit. It's like, well, the tape's the doctor. You're like, oh, okay. You know, there just came to be that we couldn't help him get beyond that delusion. So he left on his own free will, and we know where he went. And he did go into homelessness. So we consider it to be a loss anytime they exited into homelessness, as opposed to we were able to move them into a scattered site unit. So, yeah, most of those folks exited into homelessness. Of the people who have exited this year, 2 of them exited into scattered site housing. So we would still consider them to be stably housed, and for that to be a positive exit. Some of them have exited to institutions. So we consider that to be a negative exit, so it just kind of depends on where they go. But the folks that live here, they're just, after a year's time, you'd be really unlikely to be successful on your own. We have had people exit to a assisted care living, and we would consider that to be a positive exit. Usually that's going to be towards the end of their life, so that they're able to be somewhere safe and stable without additional care. We do have nursing students from the University of Portland that come and assist on the site, but we are able to provide in-home nursing care. There are other activities that go on here. Like we do movie nights. We celebrate birthdays. We have a barbecue for the 4th of July. We went on an outing to the zoo. We're really trying to help people reintegrate back into the community and to create a community. What else we got?
More questions.
Can I ask? I've always been confused about this. Like, we have a lot of supportive housing programs, once or another. How do those programs interact with Vancouver Housing Authority subsidized housing?
Yeah. Well, let's see. In a multitude of ways, like recently the Housing Authority went back to look at how do they prioritize who goes into their housing, and they decided to prioritize families and people with disabilities. So they have a direct link with the schools, and it may be that our people go into that. It may be those are people who never ended up touching the system who go into that. We don't have a direct pass-through that, let's say, somebody has become a lot healthier in a permanent supportive housing program, and now they don't need case management anymore, but they're still living in poverty, and they're not going to be able to support their housing on their own. We don't have a direct, we'd love to be able to have, we don't have a direct link to be able to say, like, okay, Housing Authority, can you take this one on, if we don't have that.
So they have long waiting lists, too, but does anybody sort of get services here while they're on the waiting list and then get housing over here and move out of the program and then to housing?
Yeah. So the people who are on the permanent supportive housing, they wouldn't be ready to just move into a Section 8 housing. In fact, the VHA would be unlikely to take them if they didn't have support of a case manager who was helping them maintain their units. They'd just be like, we can see the writing on the wall here, and this is going to be very expensive for us unless we have help in trying to help this person maintain.
To answer that part of the question, though, there is a new program unrelated to what Chair and Amy are doing, but Council for the Homeless is just starting a program called SHOP. They're going to be coming out and training our staff this next week that is going to be working with, I forget what the acronym is, but it's to do with helping families who are on wait lists like VHA. Mm-hmm. So I'll learn more about that program. Other questions?
Do we know how many units in Clark County are subsidized, rental units, or have subsidies?
I don't. The majority of the subsidies come through the Vancouver Housing Authority.
Uh-huh.
But they're not usually project-based, so they're not usually, although some of them are.
Uh-huh.
So when people built the unit, they might have had buy-downs for those units.
Right.
I would say that the county would probably be a good resource for that. For the Section 8 vouchers, you know, they're
mm-hmm.
how many are put out in the community, and there's going to be $1 million less than this year than there was last year due to federal cuts.
Yeah.
So
Peggy might be the person who can answer that question.
So Rebecca might be the person who can answer that.
So I'll defer to Michael, and we can get an idea of, I don't know if we have the exact numbers, but we can get an idea. The Vancouver Housing Authority does release a report every year, and it talks about how many units they have, so you could easily find on their website specifically what they do, but obviously wouldn't have any of the services that we provide. Are you looking for just the units themselves? Because like rapid rehousing would be different because it's not a unit; it's a household.
Well,
right.
it's funds that might not go for a full year. So for the house, I guess for all of us, like you have funds that are set aside that might buy you a certain number of units, but as prices go up and you have the same amount of money, so last year you could serve 20 people with that money. This year you could serve 17.
I'm trying to kind of enunciate this as I'm thinking about it. I'm wondering whether one of the solutions to our housing problem might be providing more subsidized housing. Maybe our subsidized housing is, we don't have enough of it. That's my point.
Definitely
no.
Well, so how do we advocate for more subsidized housing?
Federal funding.
It is mostly federal, and then it comes through this VHA for distribution.
Through multiple agencies. So we,
okay.
through this group,
uh-huh.
We have Link in Place, which is about the only one through this funding that's overseen here that would actually have created units.
But we do have community development block grant and more specifically home investment partnership funding that is through my unit that we work with that does create affordable housing or can purchase existing affordable housing and keep it on the market at market or at affordable rates when an owner is ready to sell it off. And so there is funding, and those are federal funds that come in to create the affordable housing. I'm actually in a conference yesterday and today for the National Association of County Community Economic Development Program, which is CDBG and Home Funds, that we're constantly talking about how do we create more units, because we're like 3,000 units behind where we need to be.
And just advocacy.
Thank you.
The city is doing amazing work around affordable housing. You know, the idea that government would be responsible for all of it, I think, isn't true. That you could do things like inclusionary zoning, where you ask developers, as you build new units, you need to set aside 10%, 2% of those to be affordable and to have that be over time. You get those tax break. You could do that for 20 years. As opposed to a rental subsidy that a family might have for 1 year. So trying to keep it affordable over time is going to be beyond any particular funds, but some change in policy. Mm-hmm. It would be around changing the kind of homes. People have been talking about tiny homes, so changing zoning around that. I think there's a lot of work to be done around advocacy, the county is doing.
And you always have to look at the population that you're serving. So tiny homes are not necessarily the answer for those that need permanent supported housing. You don't want to just have somebody build a tiny house on their property and put somebody in that's been chronically homeless without any supports behind their tent. That's probably going to end very well.
But for affordable housing, yes, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily need any case management. They're working two jobs and they can't afford their housing.
Right, they're working more.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you talk to us a little bit about case management? Are there different levels? How extensive do those for staff get involved in the lives of folks in your different programs?
Yeah, so it really varies. The rapid rehousing, those people who are scored as needing lesser help, the idea is less engagement, so you would assess when you initially meet them, and how are things, how are budgeting, what's income look like, is there other family issues that we need to be concerned with, and then do your best to just let them fly with minimal engagement.
Mm-hmm.
At least over a long period of time. Whereas people who are in permanent supportive housing programs, this is all voluntary services, so especially for permanent supportive housing, so they can not talk to us if they want to, but it's the case manager's job to continuously try to find ways to engage them. So they don't want to talk to me. Maybe I'm going to come back tomorrow and I'm going to bring blankets and I'm going to bring pillows and I'm going to bring something to help me get in the door. Be like, hey, I want to talk to you. I'd love to be able to see your unit. Maybe we can help decorate, like looking for ways to encourage people to be involved, even if their initial reaction was, I got what I need here, I got my housing, like that's all I wanted from you. But it's our job to help people become healthier, so you also work around substance abuse issues, which especially for people who have been living on the streets for 10, 20 years are pretty common, and then it isn't an abstinence model, it's harm reduction, so you seem to be unable to communicate right now, like let's talk tomorrow, and then let's talk about how you could maybe reduce your use as opposed to continuing to use at your current level. So the highest level of engagement is with people who are in permanent supportive housing. The common is 3 times a week. That can be more if people are experiencing crisis. It can be less if other people are experiencing crisis. But 3 times a week is pretty common for permanent supportive housing. Once a month is required for rapid rehousing, but we encourage them to engage with us more than that and reach out to them more than that because they were literally homeless just a minute ago. Probably just a little touch isn't going to help people move forward. So some of it is just helping people know what it is that they could get from us and what kind of resources we have to be able to offer them.
And then is helping them along their path to independence, how in-depth do case managers get, and then what are the case managers' caseloads like?
Yeah, so it depends on the class. For things like rapid rehousing, people need to bring forward their bank statements, like, okay, so you have X amount of money.
bring it forward. Most of us don't work on a cash-only basis anymore, so your bank statement says actually quite a lot about your spending and how that's going. And sometimes it can be pretty obvious. Like, I know why. You can't move forward in your life. You have a problem with going out to eat. So let's talk about how you could reduce that, eliminate that. You have a cable bill that's outrageous. Like, let's talk about not having a cable bill. You know, like, all some things are pretty basic that all of us who are in crisis just kind of get tunnel vision. Like, I need all this stuff. Like, you actually don't. Mm-hmm. Or there are cheaper ways to do it. Mm-hmm. So, and what's the case look like? So it depends. We used to have a solid 1 to 25, 1 to 30 ratio. But for people who are in permanent supportive housing, we prefer a 1 to 15 ratio because of the constant contact.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you.
And how many people do you have who have caseloads? I mean, what are your numbers?
Let's see. So there are 5 case managers in Aspire. There are 3 case managers for HEN. They have higher caseloads. With our scattered sites program, there are 2 case managers and 2 outreach workers who support that program. At Lincoln Place, there are 2 case managers and 2 community client support specialists. We have several staff who do this, and then we have an outreach team that, especially for our scattered site permanent supportive housing, can come and support as well. Because we transport people, and if people are experiencing crisis and they won't go in an ambulance, then we would try to transport them safely that way. Yeah, we have 6 vehicles, several case managers, and yeah, that's been kind of our whole work. And what we're really trying to focus on is not necessarily increasing the number of people that we serve, but increasing our quality of services. And so sometimes that means getting the caseloads down so they can be more manageable, we can spend that more one-on-one time and improve our success rate. Because 78% isn't bad, but it's not an A. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Thank you. Any other questions, comments for Amy? Amy, thank you. I think
thank
we
you.
Can all agree that Cher does amazing work. Okay, let's talk about January. Miss Rebecca?
Yes. So I know that it's only September, but I need to start looking at our January annual meeting. And wanted to get some ideas. Last year, the group wanted to have a more in-depth conversation with key stakeholders regarding homelessness. And so we brought in a panel, and we brought somebody from the state down to talk about the state level, and we had Council for the Homeless talk about our community and things like that. So, and it was well received. So I wanted to see if there was any ideas that you guys had for this meeting. Typically in the past, we had a 5-hour meeting, and it was a lot of business and maybe a little bit of training. And so last year, we did a full day. Training. And so that's what I'm trying to determine. Do we want to go back to the 5-hour or to a full day, keep it a full day? The executive team has come up with a couple of ideas. Because we're going to be doing an RFA soon, maybe doing an RFA 101 type training and focusing on talking about what the best practices are. And that's why we're going the direction that we're going and how to tell what is a best practice and from the different applications, the key things to look for in an application as you're making these decisions, because there are some objective scored questions that staff will take care of and will score based on meeting specific criteria, but a lot of the decision is made by the group and your subjective review of the application. And you know, does that program speak with you, and is that where you as a board member see us going? So that is one idea, which I think is a good thing to have us talk about. The other is so Lydia oversees the life skills training out in Battleground, and she's put this curriculum together. And then we were talking about, it's very similar to the trauma-informed care program that a lot of our agencies are doing training on. And so we talked about possibly doing some trauma-informed board level 101 kind of training, and having Lydia talk, you know, how does life skills fit into that trauma-informed care aspect. So that was another idea that we had had. Just yesterday, I read an article by Nonprofit and Friends, and it's about board makeup and your boards that are making funding decisions should replicate the community that you're serving. And when we look at our community that we are serving, the and I look at our board, we do not represent. When I look, I do not see minority representation on our board. We are heavily women. We are heavily youth focused. So what this article was really good, and I will find it and I will send it to you guys because I think it's a great step in getting there. But it talked a little bit about how do we move in the direction of having a board that represents the people that we serve and to make sure that we are getting voices on our board of those we are serving. The nice thing for our board is we are tripartite and we are required to have people who have experienced poverty on our board that are living in it now, that have, you know, expertise in that. We are required to have that. So that's great. I mean, we have, you know, one step in that direction. So one of the things that they recommend doing first is to have training around implicit bias. We all have implicit bias. And what happens is when we're tasked with selecting board members, we tend to pick those that are like us. And then you move away from having that diversity on the board. And I would really, I've talked with the executive team about this in the past. I really like to work towards diversity in our board and have better representation. And I think one way to do that is to start with this implicit bias type training. The staff are actually required to take this training. It's a full day training that we're going to, but I'm going to look and see if I can find a half day training. I think that would work well. We could do a morning of business and an afternoon of implicit bias training. But I also want to look for something that's ongoing, that a component I could pull into, if not all of our meetings, a regular meeting, so that we have that and we can work towards really getting our board direct representation of the community that we are serving.
So, Rebecca, how can we choose a diverse candidate if we don't even get diverse applicants?
So that is one thing, and the article talked very briefly about it. But one of the things we could do is we have a lot of white people on this board, not accept applications for people who are white. And so that limits your opportunity. You wouldn't be able to select another person who is white. You would, and we did have applicants that were minority in this last round. We had two that I can think of right off the top of my head out of the eight. So we would remove actually three. Three. And so we would remove white women applicants. So Nancy would not be
sitting here today.
But that was one of the biggest recommendations is that, you know, as you have one new spot open up, you remove the applicants that fit what you already have. And so you only have, so the minority and male that applicants that we had would have been able to move forward into the selection process.
Honestly, I don't even look at that as a variable. I look at the qualifications.
No, exactly. But we don't even ask that question. That's part of the problem with our application. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even ask that question.
Implicit bias enters because if you see a name or you see a face or a picture or something like that, you do respond. I've taken some of those implicit bias tests and they're working.
They're eye-opening. Mm-hmm. And every single person has implicit bias. It's just the way from the environment that you were raised in. I mean, it's just, it's a natural thing to have happen. And so it's not a bad, you know, it's like we're not putting down for it.
It's not a fault.
Correct.
Character. It is a fact.
Yes.
In character. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, recognizing it and dealing with it is the key.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I don't see color in the classroom anymore. I can show you instances of that. But some people do. And they read, I probably saw it somewhere down deep. But it didn't
impact. It's subconscious. I mean, a lot of the decisions we make are subconscious based on our implicit bias. And bringing that to a conscious level is what the training is about, is to have you recognize. And there's been a movement. So for a long time, you mentioned, you know, not seeing color, but that was kind of the move. Don't see color. You know, I'm color blind. But no, we want to, because people with different cultural backgrounds, we want to highlight and we want to
recognize
and know that that's going to influence how we teach them, how we talk with them, how we engage them.
And
you
to
know,
welcome that
diversity. Exactly.
The phrase, I don't see color, is false.
Right.
We all see color.
Yeah. Yes.
We all see color. Yeah. It is, I do my best to treat everybody equally.
It really should be, I treat each person in how they wish to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way I'm treated may not be the way Kelly wants to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
And we're both white.
Mm-hmm.
So, those are the things. I'm leaning towards this, and I wanted to see how you guys felt about this.
I think it's really important. Can I just say the most diverse community board I've ever seen is the CTRAN board.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever been to their community board.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a representative for every possible interest.
Awesome.
There's a blind rider representative.
Mm-hmm.
There's a deaf rider representative.
Mm-hmm.
There's a I don't ride the bus representative. You know, there's an elderly representative. So the way to achieve diversity here, I think, is by setting aside those spots.
And that's
a homeless representative.
That's one of
for
the
things
we
yes.
that.
You know,
through the application,
a minority or person of color representative,
and
women, men.
Yeah,
set aside the spots.
And that's one of the things I had already been thinking about doing is revising. I mean, we've used the same application before I even work here. So I wanted to start working towards revising the application, which we would say, what interests are you in, you know, is it youth, is it senior? We don't have anyone here that represents seniors, like that's my interest,
right.
You know, in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have two school board members. We have Lydia who works in the school. So we have a lot of youth focus.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, your passion is youth and it's fantastic. But we do. We need to diversify. And so we need to diversify in many ways,
mm-hmm.
as far as culturally, as far as interests. And so I think this might be a good way of moving us in that direction. So I will plan on a full day for our January meeting, and I will work to see what I can find for implicit bias training or any other pertinent trainings that we maybe I can fit in.
Microaggression fits right in there.
Personally, I think that training sounds amazing.
I think
so. And then I'll try to get things incorporated into, you know, regular meetings.
Mm-hmm.
If I can get some smaller, you know, I was thinking if they have something that's in modules, you know, we can
mm-hmm.
do
mm-hmm.
this topic here and this topic there at meetings. So I'll
mm-hmm.
I just literally read the article yesterday morning and I was like, boom,
yeah,
big light bulb, and let's move on.
I've got a teaser to an article too, I'll send you.
Okay.
I think that sounds really good.
Okay.
I like that.
So I'll look into what it's going to take, and then you know, we can do the RFA 101 at a future meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having a program come in, we can do that as we get closer to doing the RFA, so it'll be a little bit more clear in your mind. And then the trauma-informed care, we could probably also do that at a meeting and stuff, depending on how long this implicit bias, how much time they would
I'd rather see the implicit bias than the trauma. That's just my personal opinion.
Yeah. But I think these are great for the future.
Trauma-informed
all
the time. All
the time.
Yeah.
That's just my personal
for those of us that don't.
Right.
You have stuff that you want to do.
Go
okay, so that
time.
Sounds like a full day,
okay.
and I will move forward with that.
Okay.
So that's the annual meeting.
The annual meeting in January, so the second Tuesday of January.
And healthy food.
and help.
I did bring
it.
I know you did great.
Do we have to? Can't we have donuts?
I know.
Oh, I know. I do the gamut. Don't worry.
She does the gamut.
Healthy choices.
Healthy choices.
Open forum. Ty, do you have something?
Yeah, Peggy asked me to hand out a worksheet or a flyer. The city is hosting a fair housing workshop for property owners and property managers. So pass along to anybody you know. Today, 3:30 to 5 is the city's monthly homeless ideas group. It's always on the second Tuesday of the month from 3:30 to 5. In the Aspen room at City Hall. Aspen is the one you can reach off of the parking lot in the back. So anybody is invited to come to that.
And that's at City Hall?
City Hall, 3:30 to 5, second Tuesday. That's, I think it. Last night we got staff presented first pass at a framework for making decisions about services siting throughout the city. So I encourage you to go back and look at that workshop. It was at 5:00 last night. And then we went into executive session to talk about a potential piece of property that's large enough to accommodate multiple different things. So,
day center,
but long term, also large enough to accommodate potential of a shelter, co-located services. One of the things that was part of this framework is you know, we talked about, you know, how do we take a Bridgeview kind of model and have it in multiple places throughout the city. So this would be a first step in kind of bringing that vision.
You're talking about the Bridgeview Education
Center? Yeah, the Bridgeview Education Center, yes.
So for you guys that don't know, actually funding into the project, so the Vancouver Housing Authority has a LLC called Bridgeview Education and Employment and Education Resource Center. It's designed for those that are on Section 8. However, the community can also use it. They're just starting to build the building, but it's meant to be a resource center for people to come in. And so many different nonprofits are going to be there, partners in careers and Columbia River.
Awesome.
I mean, so a lot of things.
That's great. Under one roof.
That's great.
Yes. So it's under one roof. And it will be, it's over the Rising Stars. Have you heard of that? So it's VHA's Rising Stars Community Center. They're tearing that down and they're building the Bridgeview. It's off of Andreessen, north of MacArthur.
South of
Mill Plain?
South Mill Plain.
Okay. So Vancouver Housing Authority has a complex back there of lots of housing. And there's a Boys and Girls Club that was built a year and a half ago now. And so it's right behind that. And they're going to build more housing. Where they're tearing down Rising Stars, they're building more youth-focused housing. And so this is it's a whole resource.
Kind of right up the hill from Chair. So that's cool.
Yeah.
So the last thing, we really need the county to be partners. And so back to the advocacy stuff, really need you all to be putting pressure on the county councilors that they need to step up to the plate. And there's among certain councilors, there's a if we build it, they will come attitude. They don't. And then there's this, I don't know, the city and the county are in a great deal of tension right now.
We need to attend as individuals those county council meetings and start asking them to take action on homelessness throughout this county, because it's not just a citywide problem.
Well, and
it never has been.
One thing to keep in mind is that the majority of funding that goes into the homeless system comes through this board and through the county.
I understand that.
So, and our counselors don't even realize that. So, I mean, we do need to advocate and we do need to educate. But
how many of you of us go to a county meeting together and say,
of course we
we're all on the cat board?
You can go anytime and comment on any topic.
But if a few of us go together, I think that would be a stronger presence.
Yeah. I will not be going with you.
Okay. Ty is out.
Yes, it would not be healthy.
No.
Well, I could go sit in the back.
Is it possible to get on the agenda, or would it be more a citizen?
You just do public comment.
I know, but yeah, comments.
Do you guys want to go to the next meeting?
It's every Tuesday morning at 10.
Except for the first Tuesday of the month, it's
at night, so people can go at night, yeah. So it would be next Tuesday at 10.
I'll have to check
my calendar.
And she's already on the group, the CAB group, right?
Yes, she's a full member.
Okay, good. I'd love to go.
Full board.
Especially if we all went, I think that, or a few of us anyway.
I think that's great, representing CAB.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We have to talk about our statements
just
ahead of time.
Every week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that'd be awesome. I'm game.
What is that date?
Okay.
It's Tuesday. Or the week from today.
Are we there for today? So our next meeting is going to be November 14th, right here.
And look forward to my email a couple weeks in advance with the completed community needs assessment for final review.
Yep. Awesome. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, staff, for all the support. We appreciate everything you do. We are adjourned.
There we go.
Yay!
I have read this over there.
Thank you.
Because it talks about people going into homesteads.